Since the Second World War, and especially since the end of the Cold War, U.S. dominance as a global superpower has been accepted as the conventional wisdom of geopolitics. In her new book, Geopolitical Economy, University of Manitoba Political Studies professor Radhika Desai argues that the power of the U.S. economy has been much weaker than is often supposed, and points towards a future where some of the former colonies in the global south will play a greater role in world affairs. Radhika Desai joins me in the studio today. Welcome, Radhika.
Thank you, Josh. Glad to be here.
So the United States emerged at the end of the Second World War with something like 50% of global manufacturing capacity and a large share of the world trade. But unlike Great Britain in the 19th century, it did not translate that economic dominance into a formal political empire. How did that happen?
Well, it was simply not possible for the United States to do so. In fact, back in the late 19th century, when the United States first sort of, you know, well, basically when the Western frontier was reached, it looked farther west across the Pacific and said, well, now what? And it soon realized that thanks to the fact that other empires who had been, you know, there much earlier, and of course, some emerging nations, states had already divided up the world between them. And it was very clear that the cost of acquiring colonies had escalated massively. It was also the case that the United States found out in the Philippines, for example, that there was nationalist resistance, which was now much greater than it had been in the 18th and early 19th centuries when most of the European countries acquired their empires. So all told, basically, the cost of acquiring a formal empire was simply too great for the United States.
At the same time, it did create a form of neocolonialism across the world.
Yes. I mean, what I argue, and in fact, what I also found very surprising when I first found out about it when I was reading around in this area, is that, of course, if you think about it in one way, right from its 1776, from the Declaration of Independence onwards, the United States had thought of itself as an empire. I mean, contrary to everybody who will tell you, oh, the United States was born in an anti-imperialist move and so on, it thought of itself as an empire. And then by the early 20th century, when the frontier was reached, when formal colonies were basically too difficult to get, the United States elites very explicitly formulated the aim of imitating British dominance, which was clear in the 19th century but was now waning. And they said, all right, well, if we can't imitate British dominance completely, we cannot imitate its empire, it's impossible, but what we're going to try and do is we're going to try and create make the dollar the world's currency, and London the world, and New York the world's financial center, in the place of sterling and London. Of course, what it forgot is that what made it possible for London to maintain the sterling as the world's currency and London as the world's financial center was the very fact that it had formal colonies whose surpluses it exported, providing liquidity for world trade.
Now, the United States has, since the Second World War, had a series of ideologies that you document that justify its role in world affairs, that claiming that the United States' power is necessary for the smooth functioning of capitalism. Is that right?
Yes, of course. I mean, there was early on, of course, the Cold War ideology and so on. But what we, but the real Cold War ideology portrayed the United States as the leader of the free world. But the idea of U.S. hegemony, it may surprise many people to know, did not really come into being until the 1970s. And what's really interesting about this is that it came into being precisely at a moment when, according to the very people who were floating the idea of U.S. hegemony, it had already ended. They pointed to the 50s and 60s as the classic era of U.S. hegemony. It was now in crisis. And basically, all these theories of U.S. hegemony were trying to dress up U.S. actions in the period since the 1970s as somehow an attempt to recreate a stable world order, instead of, in fact, the pursuit of U.S. imperial ambitions. Imperial not in the sense that it had formal colonies or had anything of the sort, but in its attempt to make the dollar the world's currency and make New York the world's financial center.
And throughout this whole period, there's been a you know, a career of imperial hubris in the United States with military failures from Korea, Vietnam, and up till Iraq and Afghanistan.
In fact, and one thing I should have said earlier, because I think people should know this, is that, you know, you've heard people say that the United States is still hegemonic. You've heard a few other people who will say, well, it was once hegemonic, but it now no longer is. And then it varies when they date the decline from, but they say something like that. My book actually says that the United States was never anything called hegemonic. The very idea of hegemony was, you know, appeared to dress up U.S. actions in a certain way. Rather, what you have is a series of attempts, all of which failed, to make the dollar the world's currency and New York the world's financial center. Now, of course, people will say, well, the dollar has been the world's currency. But what my book documents is that it has remained the world's currency, not as a kind of stable set of arrangements, but a series of arrangements, each of which fails and is succeeded by another stratagem.
And also over the past several decades, we've seen institutions like the IMF and the World Bank trying to impose neoliberal patterns of development and free trade throughout the world. But you argue that many of the most successful attempts at development, particularly in the global south, have taken a different path.
Yes. I mean, of course, one should not, first of all, I should say that the imposition of neoliberal policies, especially beginning in the 1980s and during the 1980s in particular, was part of this stratagem, because what it did is it imposed structural adjustment on third world countries and what we now call the reverse capital flows, capital flowing from the south to the north. Those reverse capital flows were part of what gave the dollar its strength for that brief period. But nevertheless, the point is absolutely correct that the United States tried to impose neoliberal policies as a way of keeping the third world countries in their place. However, some of these third world countries were powerful enough to resist these policies. Yes, to some extent, you know, it looks as though, you know, China went market reform-oriented, India, etc., and of course, Russia is the case is quite huge. Obviously, they gave up communism and adopted neoliberal reforms. But somehow, for the leaders of all these countries, they were able to modify the neoliberal message and retain a sufficiently great state role. And it is this retention of a state role that is responsible for their development. And of course, there is another part to this, that there is a retention in the period after the 80s and 90s, but there is also the period before that, which laid the foundation through statist development of the development of all these countries, whether it was communism in China and Russia, or state-led development in India and many other countries besides Brazil as well.
And so there's emerged a block of countries commonly called the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa.
That's right.
And have they been working together in recent years to create an alternative?
Well, I think that the first BRICS summit was held in the aftermath of the recent financial crisis. And the recent financial crisis is important because, to my mind, and as I argue in the book, it marks the end of U.S. attempts even to seriously to make a serious attempt to reestablish the dollar as the world's currency. It remains there by default, but its role is shrinking quite rapidly. And the BRICS are in the forefront of taking steps to reduce this role, because they don't want to be landed with valueless dollars. They are they're much less valuable today than they were when the BRICS first acquired them, and they're about to be less so. So the BRICS want to insulate themselves from the losses. So yes, they have been in the forefront of this, and the first BRICS summit took place in 2009, right after the crisis. They have continued to meet every year since then, and slowly and gradually a strategy is emerging in which they basically would like to effectively create institutions that form a direct challenge to the IMF, the World Bank, and other forms of international economic governance that are dominated by the United States in particular and the Western countries in general. And so, for example, today, Brazil, only one country of these countries, Brazil's own development bank, lends more money to the world than does the World Bank. So that's just one. Now they are also going to get together and create a BRICS Development Bank. And people point out, well, these are a bunch of disparate countries. But the funny thing is, what gives them the unity is that they have all developed against and despite U.S. attempts to keep them in their place. And they understand how the world order worked in the past, how U.S. attempts to dominate have compromised their interests, and they have no intention, or rather, let me put it another way, they intend to do everything in their power to ensure that such things don't recur.
So many of these countries, like China, Brazil, countries in Africa as well, have used the combined power of state and local industry to create an alternative form of development. And I think China in particular, we've seen be spectacularly successful in developments, the second largest economy in the world now. But they've also imported a lot of the class relations from the capitalist north. Is there a risk for a lot of these countries that class conflict and divisions could create a form a break for on development in these areas?
I think that it would be a mistake for us if we saw state-led development as somehow Eastern or Southern, and capitalist development, or somehow some kind of, you know, capitalist class-led development as somehow Western. In every capitalist country that we know, and this is one of the central arguments of my book, the state has always played a very, very major role in development. There's a very interesting Cambridge economist called Ha-Joon Chang, who wrote a very good book with a very interesting title called Kicking Away the Ladder. And what he pointed out is that by proposing neoliberal policies, by proposing that the state should be withdrawn, that only markets should be allowed free play, what the Western countries were doing were effectively kicking away the ladder, because they were preventing developing countries from using the same means through which they themselves developed in order to develop. So this was precise. So on all sides, you could not have had the levels of prosperity that you had in all of these countries had it not been for state intervention and state-sponsored developments of all sorts.
And so what does this circumstance say about opportunities for economic development in Canada?
That's a very good question. And I think that in all countries, I mean, basically Canada, of course, it's important to remember that through a series of, I think, very lucky coincidences for Canada, we have escaped the worst of the financial crisis. But, of course, the financial crisis does mean that our own growth has been affected, because that of our partners, particularly the United States, has been affected. And I think that what it means is that the Canadian state has a role to play in development. It has a role to play in several respects. Number one, Canada can certainly do a lot more to expand its own internal market by rectifying the income inequalities that have grown, particularly since the 1990s, but even before then, since the 1970s. So that can be rectified. I think a number of initiatives can be taken to ensure that investment is made in productive industry and not in speculation, not in purely financial activity, and to make sure that banking and finance actually play the role that it is supposed to play, which is to be the handmaiden of production, not the master of production, and certainly not something that strangles productive activity. Canada also has a lot of resources, and we are lucky that way. However, we could be trading on our luck too much if we simply export unprocessed. I mean, this is a long-standing debate in Canada, and we have to stop being the hewers of wood and drawers of water and actually process much of what we have within Canada in order to do whatever, use it ourselves, export it, etc., etc. So I think that increasing the value added in Canada is also another thing that the state can support us doing, diversifying our trading links as well. I think that particularly with these emerging economies and so on, I mean, at some level, of course, Canada we have a very large economy as our neighbor, and we cannot ignore them. And I'm not suggesting that we do. But on the other hand, we also need to make sure that we get as good a deal with our trade with the United States as possible. One of the things people often confuse is free trade and more trade. My own view is that you can trade as much or as little as you want or as you need. But free trade is one guarantee of actually, that is to say, a policy of simply opening up markets is guaranteed to cost you economically. Managed trade, where for you know between two countries or many countries for mutual benefit, is much more likely to increase trade because it will be likely to increase economic growth.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with about these issues.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Radhika Desai, professor of political studies at the University of Manitoba and author of Geopolitical Economy, After U.S. Hegemony, Globalization, and Empire. The book is published by Pluto Press and Fernwood Publishing. You're listening to Mud and Water on CKUW 95.9 FM.